It probably reached its peak, as far as Christianity goes, in the definition of a just war by a pre-Reformation theologian called Aquinas. And he produced a yardstick by which the justice of any war. But just to remind you of what Aquinas said, for a war to be just. And there are two parts to this. There is the war itself just? And then, is the conduct of the war just? And both are obviously linked, but are quite distinct. The one, can we go to war? The other, what can we do to remain moral and just when we fight the war? The first point, of course, and some of this is so obvious, it's because it's become ingrained in our culture, our whole background, that war must be waged in response to aggression. That it must be engaged in with the aim of avoiding evil and producing good. That peace must be its ultimate objective. That the reasons of revenge, revolt, or a desire to harm another person or exploit other societies is not a justification to go to war. That every possible means of avoiding war and resolving the problem must be tried before war can be undertaken. That there must be a serious prospect of success. That bloodshed without any hope of victory can't be justified. It's very interesting on that point. It's arguable that Britain going to war in 1939 was not justified. On the face of it, there was no possibility whatsoever of Britain winning in those circumstances. The war must be declared by a legitimate authority, that is, by a government that's got legitimacy. Of course, nowadays, for example, Saddam Hussein, perhaps President Assad, it is argued by many that they have no legitimacy within their nation. Therefore, they themselves cannot use violence in a justified in using violence to achieve their ends, even if their ends are of a peaceful nature. It must not create a greater evil than that which you are trying to overcome. Having seen Iraq for 2 years after Saddam Hussein's overthrow, I have to say, certainly when I left Iraq in 2007, and from what I understand from contacts and friends who are still there, most Iraqis would tell you that the situation is actually worse than it ever was under Saddam Hussein. And if you're a Christian in Iraq, you have really serious problems. The war, as I said, it must be conducted in a moral way, perhaps more of that later. Non-combatants, civilians, must not be harmed. Well, when Aquinas produced this justification, it was very easy to distinguish between a combatant and a non-combatant. A member of the ruling classes might be engaged by a monarch to raise a regiment. They would be raised from within his lands and they would go to war with their landowner. Nowadays, and with the advent of professional armed services, we cannot say that a civilian population exists in isolation from the armed services. Our armed services are a product of our society. They are equipped by industry in Britain. So it becomes very difficult to say when a nation goes to war nowadays whether there is such a thing as an innocent civilian, because the war effort is a national effort, not the effort of individuals who are clearly marked out as those who have opted to fight a war, as distinct from those who continue to till the land. And the same, by extension, could be said of the serviceman himself. When a professional soldier becomes a professional soldier, he gives up the right to decide whether a conflict is just or not. His government tells him when to fight and when to stop fighting, and to a degree, how to fight. So he doesn't have the choice. And that in itself is a moral issue. What does a person do when his government sets him on a course where he's going to use his armed might in a situation that he himself believes to be unjustifiable? Cromwell was aware of this. and said words to the effect, and my quotes, I'm afraid, are in general rather than precise, a soldier must know why he is on the battlefield, and he must love what he knows. That is, a soldier's got to know why he's going to war, and he must agree with why he is going to war. I know the 2003 invasion of Iraq caused great disquiet within the army, so much so that two soldiers, Muslims, refused to soldier. And it says, I think, a great deal of credit to our armed services that they suffered no penalty. They were simply withdrawn from their unit and returned to the UK. But prior to that, the last time there was anything approaching a mutiny in the British Army was with the Suez Crisis, when again certain officers rather than soldiers felt that that adventure into Suez was unjustifiable and immoral, and caused some concern at the time by apparently encouraging their soldiers to mutiny. But on the whole, Britain has been saved from that kind of problem. But it was a serious problem in 2003 for some servicemen as well as for our civil population. When engaging in war, force should be used proportionately, which again is a modern phenomenon that cuts two ways. The Western powers defend themselves with high-tech methods. It is suggested, with some justification, that leaves the West vulnerable to the man with a big wooden club. Look at Vietnam. America, a highly sophisticated and technologically advanced nation, was defeated literally by barefoot natives who were able to circumvent the benefits, as they were seen, of the high-tech weaponry. It's perhaps not quite the same now in the West, but we do have to face the fact that any threat to our culture is not coming from uniformed individuals trying to land on our shores. It is more discreet. It is more difficult to identify. It is more individuals who are living within a community and have access through perhaps modern communications, the internet particularly, and I'll come back to this, that are representing a threat to our security and therefore to our accepted freedoms and customs and ways of life. And finally, conquered peoples and prisoners should be treated justly. That's, as it were, the ground rules that Aquinas laid down, which are still, on the whole, used today, though I will go on to suggest that they need serious revision, almost to the point of being discarded. I want to therefore consider the Falklands War and the invasion of Iraq in 2003 from a background of these points. In a way, the Falklands is much more black and white. Islands that were under the protection of our government were invaded. There was, of course, a great deal of argument at the time whether the task force that sailed within days of the invasion was not too quick a response and too urgent a military response, that we hadn't attempted a solution by all other means. And you may remember, those who are a bit older, that the American government attempted with General Haig a settlement with his shuttle diplomacy, as it was called, between Argentina and Britain. And that failed, and so armed force was used to evict the Argentines. And I personally felt that the Argentines would not ever be talked off the islands, or indeed forced off them by any form of economic or political retribution. I believed that the Argentine mindset could not tolerate the disgrace, as it would be seen, the loss of face to backing down, and anything other than a complete withdrawal would have been leaving the islanders victims of the invasion. I also felt, for the first time, I suppose, personally involved in what for me is the greatest difficulty in being a pacifist. I can, and indeed have, gone onto a battlefield unarmed. I would find it very, very difficult not to respond with the necessary violence if somebody for whom I was responsible was offered violence. For me, that's the hardest part of being a pacifist. I can take whatever punishment, taking that standpoint, might result in, but I would not find it possible to stand by and let somebody for whom I was responsible take that sort of punishment. And if we want to talk about pacifism later, well, we may do so. But as a marker, it's not violence to me that's a problem. It's violence to somebody for whom I'm responsible and who cannot defend themselves that provides the real problem for pacifism. But make no mistake about it, I am pleased that we have pacifists, because if we didn't have a voice arguing for non-violence, then there would be little to restrain the level to which violence itself goes. And I certainly remember reminding my commanding officer at the time, in fact the third commanding officer I had in the Falklands War, we went through a fight quite a rate, that once we'd taken Stanley and the Argentines had surrendered, we had got to adopt a different stance as a battalion. We could not treat the Argentine soldiers, who for the first night were in the other half of Stanley, we could not treat them as a viable enemy who must be engaged when we saw them. And subsequently, the whole character of the battalion had to change to that of peacekeeping rather than what is nowadays called war fighting. And there is a big difference. And it's very easy once you've got into the habit of destroying that which is a threat. Doesn't matter, private property means nothing when you're at war. If it's a threat, you destroy it or you neutralise it. We couldn't do that once the Argentines had surrendered. And indeed, surrender itself is a bit of a grey area, because clearly they'd given up fighting before there was a formal surrender. So one had to remind our commanders that we needed to restrain ourselves. And for me, having pacifists in our society provides that very purpose. It's a restraining voice. It's a voice that's saying, have you looked at other ways? I'm not a pacifist, but I wouldn't be without them. Falklands War was, as I've said, I think black and white in the reasons for going to war and in the way in which the war was fought. There were very few British forces taken prisoner by the Argentines. I can only think of one pilot who was shot down, and he was treated well. And certainly my experience of Argentine prisoners was that they were treated very well. Indeed, on one occasion, a soldier at Goose Green, when we'd taken something like 1,100 prisoners, and they were in groups taken back to about 30 miles to where we landed so that they could be kept in prisoner of war cages. I remember one of the soldiers who'd taken some of these Argentine prisoners back saying to me when he returned that he was very upset, because he felt that the Royal Marine Guards in the prisoner of war cages were being far too harsh to the prisoners. As he said to me, we could treat them well and they were trying to kill us. So why can't they treat them better than they are doing? Well, yeah, I've no first-hand experience of how the prisoners were treated. I have no reason to believe that they were treated anything other than fairly but firmly, as it should be. I believe the only act of torture that was given to the Argentines, curiously enough, was given by our chief medical officer when he told them that they'd been knocked out of the World Cup. And believe me, you could hear the clunk as Argentine morale hit rock bottom at that point. But they were treated fairly, and it was, as it were, a clean war. There were events within the battlefield that one wonders about. Jim Barry, a junior officer from my battalion, who went forward to either negotiate or take a surrender, and along with two of his soldiers was machine gunned. And you do accept that there is a point at which you cannot surrender. After Jim had been shot, along with Corporal Sullivan and another Tom, his company did not take any prisoners from that Argentine position. You cannot shoot at a person until he's standing in front of you and then say, OK, I give up, and expect him not to be a bit peeved. And that's warfare. It is not nice. And anybody who thinks it's Hollywood, it's not. Not nice at all. But it is undertaken by men who understand better than anybody what they are about, and who I believe have an ingrained morality. But they are human beings. They do need training, they do need discipline, as we all do. And sometimes that proves to be less than one would like it to be. But that's not necessarily a reason for branding them all inhuman animals. After the Falklands War, we had the curious business of a Metropolitan Police team investigating alleged atrocities and went to Argentina, went onto national television in Argentina and asked if anybody had been in the Malvinas, and if they did and became prisoners, had they anything to complain about the way they were treated? Or indeed, had any of them anything to complain about with regard to the British forces? Well, you know, that seems to me to be taking it a bit far. And at some point, you know, you have to be loyal to your own people who've done your dirty work. And I'm now, of course, moving on to prejudice and emotion rather than reasoned thought. So I'm already falling into the pit that I mentioned we had to be wary of right at the start. But again, when you've got a policeman comes to you, when you've been a company sergeant major and fought the Battle of Longdon, which was a hard battle that our 3rd Battalion fought, and say there are allegations that you threw hand grenades into caves knowing that there were Argentine troops there. Is that true? To which the answer was, yes, I did. At which point he was cautioned and then asked, did you call on them to tell them you were going to throw hand grenades in before you did? And he said, no, I didn't. They were then asked, well, why didn't you? To which he could only reply, because they were shooting at me. When you have that level of concern about morality of warfare, about the ethics of the battlefield, no officer, no commander, no soldier is going to do anything other than ensure that his men know, as far as he can, what they may and may not do. But what do you do in that split second when you've got to make your mind up whether that man is a threat to me or not? In Hollywood terms, is it my life or his? And I had a lot of dealing with one of our soldiers subsequent to the Falklands who had, I wouldn't call them psychological problems, but he was certainly very concerned because during the Battle of Goose Green, an Argentine position had surrendered. The Argentine soldiers came out of the bunker that they'd occupied. One came out carrying a rifle, and this soldier shot him. He believed, he said, that he thought this man was still fighting. There were no problems until he got back to the United Kingdom, when he then saw footage of the surrender of British troops when the Argentines invaded, and he saw a Royal Marine Party coming out of Government House, and one of them was carrying a rifle. And he'd, of course, not been shot. His surrender had been accepted. And for the Tom from Tupara, the soldier from Tupara, suddenly he wondered, had he done the right thing? Had the Argentine himself been so frightened, so confused, he wasn't thinking? Was he a conscript who'd been told, never go anywhere without your rifle? So when he was surrendering, he carried his rifle. He will never know, I will never know, and one could just see this soldier through it, and all one could say was, you did what you thought was right at the time. And it does boil down to an individual decision. And it may be right, and it may be wrong, and it can certainly be made to appear wrong if in the time after a conflict, with all the time in the world and the leisure to investigate and to reason and to think about a situation, any action can be found to be at least doubtful. But for the person at the time, there is no time for that luxury of reasoning. It is literally a split-second decision. And that action that follows that decision is with that person for the rest of his life. And again, I was humbled. I was going to say humiliated. I was certainly humbled by one of our soldiers on the way back from the Falkland Islands who said, sir, I appreciated the service we had in Stanley, and I appreciated what you said, but I think you should have asked on our behalf for all of us to be forgiven. But what about 2003? You will know what your own feelings were about our invading Iraq. Tony Blair placed a great deal of confidence in the moral argument, and he was supported by Professor of War Studies at King's College London, Lawrence Freedman, Sir Lawrence Freedman as he now is, who added two conditions, as it were, or two reasons when war may be justified that do not appear in Aquinas. One was that an act of genocide can never be an internal matter. That is, if Saddam Hussein was executing his own people, it was not a matter that could be confined only to Iraq. That is, the external world had not just a right, but it had a requirement to intervene. And secondly, when oppression creates a massive flow of refugees, which unsettles neighbouring states, then they can properly be considered to be threats to international peace and security. And he added one further one, just to make sure that there are three rather than two, that when regimes are based on minority rule, they lose legitimacy. Well, that last point, you could argue in many ways. We have a government that has not actually had a majority rule, if you look at total numbers of individuals in the country who have voted for them. They have simply won the largest number of seats in Parliament. My personal feelings are that there was no moral justification for invading Iraq. Saddam Hussein was not a person that we would have wanted as our governor. We would not have wanted anything like the situation that obtained in Iraq. But one cannot judge entirely by one's own standards. The Arab world is a very different world from ours. And the West has, in my opinion, and there are those of you here who perhaps are able to contradict me because you know far more about it than I do, the Arab world is not one that has in any way really accepted the Western ways. And yet we continually misunderstand that. I think the Arab world is ready to accept modernization, but modernization for the Arab is not the same as westernization. And we believe modernization is westernization. And for the Arab, it's not. So they can accept all that we take perhaps for granted. Modern communications, televisions, internet, electrical goods, high-tech goods, motor cars, all that. That doesn't mean that they are accepting our way of doing things. It doesn't mean that they can accept democracy. I'm not criticising them for that. I'm saying we have to recognise the difference in our cultural relations. And to measure the justification of going to war or invading an Arab country, whether we do it as bluntly as we did in Iraq or as discreetly as we might be invited to do in Syria, we have to think very, very hard, because we are not dealing with a culture that is the same as ours. And despite what has been called the Arab Spring, I do not believe that that represents a move towards a Western type of culture. So when we try to justify any intervention with armed forces, we have to be very careful how we go about it, because we can't do it on our terms. And indeed, if there is a political philosophy, as was Marxism, that sees warfare as an integral part of that political system, how does a political system that does not see warfare as anything other than very much a last resort deal with it? And the bottom line again is humanity. All methods were tried to stop Libya supplying arms to the IRA. It only really stopped when the Americans bombed Libya, and it stopped immediately. So again, our Western way of doing things and our ideals in dealing with each other may not work in societies that don't accept the same underlying principles, which isn't to say that we willingly or warmly accept war. I remember a commanding officer again at the end of the Falklands campaign said to me, "There must be a better way of solving international dispute than this." Very much the same sort of thing that Wellington had said after the Battle of Waterloo, but in a different language. I think Aquinas's arguments are of very limited value to justify a war today. We live in societies that have professional armed forces where warfare is a national effort. You cannot distinguish easily the civilian from the soldier, perhaps with the single exception of children, but even then, one has seen children carrying arms. And what do you do? And this was a real problem in Iraq. I spoke to an American soldier who had been faced with a child carrying a rifle. He did not shoot the child, and I spoke to him in hospital because the child had shot him. What do you do? What do you do when suicide vests are put on children and children are sent to go and talk to an American soldier or a British soldier at a vehicle checkpoint, and somebody some distance away presses the button that detonates the suicide vest? How do you deal with that kind of situation? Do you shoot the child? They might be theoretical questions for us, but they're very real questions for soldiers standing on the streets of Afghanistan. Another soldier killed today by an Afghan wearing an Afghan army uniform. How do you deal with it? How do you deal, as we found in Northern Ireland, with a passively supportive population? There were those who would not do anything actively to help the IRA, but they supported them passively. They would do nothing to interfere with what the IRA were doing. They would do nothing to warn the authorities of anything that came their way by way of understanding what the IRA might be planning. It's a great problem. How do you face it? I would suggest that we are at the beginning of a revolution, and that revolution is going to encompass all parts of our life. It's not a revolution like the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution. It's a revolution like the Industrial Revolution. It's a whole change in the foundations of society, and in this case, not just within Britain, but in the rest of the world. And without going into, again, a history lesson, which I'm sure there are people here who are more equipped to talk about it than I am, the Industrial Revolution in our country saw the settled communities of rural life with the church, the clergy, the lord of the manor, laying down literally the law, the morality, structured communities where each knew the other, neighbours knew neighbours, mutually supporting, being uprooted, moving into cities, living in terrace houses, where the squire no longer existed, let alone had any authority, and where the church might not exist, or the vicar wasn't somebody who'd married my parents and baptised me and would marry me. That whole shift in the foundations of culture and society, I believe, is occurring now. But it's international. We look at multiculturalism. Look at communications. Al-Qaeda operates as a group where individuals do not know each other. They couldn't tell the police who the other person was because they've never met them. The internet makes it possible for a person who accepts the philosophy to become a member without joining, simply by conducting their own guerrilla warfare. Communications have started changing, economies are changing. We've seen the problems with banks, we've seen the problems of our government still trying to control, and not just our government, control the economic situation. Nobody knows what to do because nobody knows what the ground rules are anywhere. Each acts in the belief that what they are doing will be right, and only history will prove whether it is or it isn't. And the same is true for the armed services. The asymmetric warfare, as it's called, a high-tech army confronted with a civilian population that contains within it those who will fight but can't be identified, and who can use modern means of communication and sophistication to coordinate their effort. It won't be in any of our lifetimes before this is settled and some sort of normality and understood rules and customs and cultures are there again. But it will come. But we've got to live through the turmoil. And perhaps as part of it, as people do when they are uncertain, they jump back to what they know. Is it that the growth of a more conservative, indeed even it's called fundamentalist, which isn't a word I like, but an ultra-conservative Islam, a product of individuals who see a world that's changing and they don't quite know how to cope with it, so they jump back. How often have you heard our politicians saying, we are going back to the old values? People become conservative when they become anxious and uncertain. And within that uncertainty, we are faced with different forms of aggression that have to be countered, and we have to use the forces that are necessary to counter them. And the morality of that is still being hammered out.